Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung. Und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe. Das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden, guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election, and how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the World Service of the BBC, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in London today for talks with Arab leaders about how to de-escalate the Middle East conflict. He's meeting foreign ministers from Jordan and the UAE and the Lebanese Prime Minister. He's been trying to get a ceasefire for many, many months now with strikingly little progress. Is that about to change? This is what he had to say before the meetings in London began.
We've had very good and important conversations this week, including this morning, on ending the war in Gaza and charting a path for what comes next. And those conversations will continue, but I think this is a moment of importance and urgency that we're working to seize.
We've got a report from Gaza itself in just a moment, but first let's get up to date with all this diplomacy. And we've got our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman on the line. You've been travelling with the Secretary of State, so tell us, you know, how this fits into his few days of diplomacy.
Well, there's two things to say, really, in that what Antony Blinken's been doing, both in the region and here in London, where I am now, has been to talk to both the Israelis and to Arab leaders. Less about the ceasefire and hostage release deal that has been stalled for many, many weeks now, and more about the so-called day-after plan, the plan for a post-conflict Gaza, how Gaza would be run, basically secured, rebuilt, and crucially governed at the end of the war. Now, it might seem a bit odd that they're sort of moving to that stage before they've even got an agreement over a ceasefire. But I think what the Americans are trying to do now is to get that plan very much down on paper as a sort of fait accompli, so that it might then make it a bit easier to get the ceasefire process and hostage release done, because what they were going to do was have this part as a second phase during the ceasefire. I think they want it clearly bolted down now, so that might be a sort of reverse way of making progress with the ceasefire.
Yes, I see what you're saying, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you go back, 10 months, the Middle Eastern governments, the Arab governments, were all saying, we will not discuss the post-conflict arrangements for Gaza until we've got firm commitments towards progress on two states. And that's gone, right?
Well, I think they've shifted a bit on that because of the duration of the war. Also because what the Americans are saying is that Hamas militarily are broken. You know, the Israelis have achieved that objective. And they're trying to hold the Israelis to their word on that and then sort of give the Israelis an off-ramp to say, OK, we'll get Arab sponsorship for a post-war Gaza so you can withdraw, because that's a crucial American condition. They don't want a continuing occupation, but of course they need Arab sponsorship to help run the place and to put money in, basically. And in terms of the demand for two states, well, the Arabs sort of feel they've got that from the Americans, because that has always been an American demand, basically, of the Israelis, that in the long term that it moves towards a two-state solution with an independent Palestinian state in Gaza, the West Bank and East Jerusalem, as has always been the long-term sort of formula for peace. You hear that being discussed much less, I have to say, when they're talking about all this, because I think they realise that's a much longer-term objective. And certainly this Israeli government has categorically rejected it as a future for Gaza or for the Palestinians altogether. So clearly, you know, the Americans have their work cut out here.
Yep, thanks very much. That was Tom Bateman following all these meetings in London today. Let's speak now to Ibrahim Al-Jazi, who until last month served as Minister of State for Prime Ministry Affairs in Jordan. Thank you for joining us. Have the Jordanians accepted what we just heard Tom Bateman sort of saying there, really, that the goal of two states is off for the long until the long term?
Hi, Owen. Well, actually, our stand in Jordan is still the same regarding the two-state solution. We are firm on this, and we continue to believe in this. And the only way to achieve that is through a negotiation. We are working for, you know, an independent, you know, Palestinian state on Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem as its capital. Ultimate goal.
Sure, but
when it comes to the current situation, it's a different story.
Well, what is that story? I mean, do you agree with this idea of trying to fix up arrangements from what Gaza might look like after the conflict at this stage?
Well, it is too early to discuss the post-Gaza war, unless there is an immediate ceasefire. Without an immediate ceasefire and pulling out the Israeli, you know, occupation forces from Gaza, that would be impossible to achieve. You know, we have, you know, atrocities and inhumane and, you know, activities that are taking place in Gaza and the West Bank. The horror Israel is bringing to the entire population nowadays, exactly today, on northern Gaza is inhumane. It's unbelievable. It's considered to be a war crime the whole humanity should not really tolerate anymore.
As you know, Israel wants to improve its own security. And, you know, with that in mind, there is an attack on Iran coming up. What do you feel that will do for Jordanian stability?
Well, we are a strong, nation. We still believe into negotiation, but you know, regarding the, we made it very clear that we will not, permit any kind of involvement, regarding our. On territories in such a conflict. What we believe in, you know, still regarding Gaza and the West Bank and to stop the atrocities as well as in Lebanon and to reach, an immediate ceasefire.
I mean, everything you're saying suggests that, Jordan is not going to be a big voice in this debate. I mean, you know, it's not your fault, but you just don't have the power to impose yourself on this.
Well, we have a strong voice regarding what we are, regarding our policies regarding the West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well our, involvement in the latest, conference that took place in Paris as far as Lebanon is concerned. That's clear, and our policies are, firm on that. And I strongly believe that Mr. Safadi made it clear about our leading role in that, and our coordination with the American and our, different Western allies regarding these issues, whether it was like regarding the humanitarian issue or about the ceasefire. That's we are hoping to achieve.
Mr. Safadi, your foreign minister. Okay, well, look, thanks very much for giving us your perspective there. That was Ibrahim Al-Jazi. Well, that's the diplomacy. Let's get a report from the ground now. Israel doesn't allow journalists, including the BBC, to go to Gaza except on highly supervised trips, occasional ones with the army. But because our journalists aren't there, the BBC relies on Palestinian freelance journalists and individuals to get information out. And one such moment came on Monday. There was a video showing civilians killed and wounded in an Israeli strike on a UN school in northern Gaza that was being used as a shelter. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, in Jerusalem, has been following some of the people who were in that video.
From the outside, it's hard to comprehend the depth of suffering experienced by civilians in Gaza. On Monday this week, a video emerged from Jabalia that gave an unusually detailed insight into the pressure and the horror imposed on civilians by Israel's current offensive in northern Gaza. Watching it, you feel almost like an eyewitness. In the video, a paramedic called Naveen Al-Dawawi runs between dead and dying civilians, trying to help them as she films with her phone. When I reported this first on Monday, she was misidentified as Nabila. Close to panic herself, Naveen is telling a woman sitting in a deep pool of her own blood to stay calm. I swear, she says, I don't have anything to stop the bleeding. We managed to track down Naveen in Gaza City, much more composed now. She was able to give a freelance journalist working for the BBC her own account of what happened on Monday morning. Naveen said they'd been besieged at the Jabalia Boys Elementary School for 16 or 17 days. Then on Monday, a quadcopter, a small drone the IDF uses for surveillance and killing, flew low over their shelter.
We were living in so much fear when the school was hit. We had people killed and injured. 3 days ago, a drone descended on the school at 9 in the morning, giving us an ultimatum that we needed to leave before 10. The drone loudspeaker said we had to evacuate the school because we were in a dangerous fighting zone. We didn't have time to pack our stuff. It gave us just an hour. After just 10 minutes, Israeli airplanes bombed the school.
In the video, a woman's voice is heard saying, "My children are gone." Naveen says, "How do you know?" The mother says, "Look at them." Journalists working for the BBC found the woman, Lina Abunamos, in Kamal Adwan Hospital in Jabalia, with shrapnel wounds and unbearable grief.
I saw my daughter dying with my own eyes. She was dying in front of me. I couldn't stop it, and she was my eldest. My whole life, I couldn't save her.
Israel insists its forces respect the laws of war, and it says that civilians get killed in Gaza because Hamas uses them as human shields. We put that to Naveen Al-Dawawi, the paramedic. Our reporter asked whether Hamas was using civilians as human shields. No, she said. Hamas was not doing that. They were protecting us and standing with us. For many in Israel, that statement will justify the horrors that the IDF brought down on the civilians just after 9 in the morning in that school on Monday, the 21st of October. But the laws of war state that force used by an attacking army needs to be proportionate. A major Hamas presence might legally justify killing and wounding civilians, including many children. A few low-level gunmen would not. In the hospital, Lina Abunamos was haunted by the loss of her eldest daughter, her only son, and everything they called home.
What crime have the children committed? What have they done? What have we done to deserve this? All the children, just like my daughter, they have shrapnel in their legs. I swear they've destroyed our children.
And that was Lina Abunamos ending Jeremy Bowen's report. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. Coming up on NewsHour today, the release of a baby monkey that was rescued from being tortured.
monkeys are being loaded in their boxes onto small fishing boats, crossing over to a pristine jungle-covered island reserve, the perfect place for many to be released into.
And some headlines. A court in Uganda has sentenced Thomas Kwayelo, a former commander in the Lord's Resistance Army, to 40 years in jail for war crimes. President Zelensky of Ukraine says he's received intelligence that Russia may deploy North Korean troops to the battlefield as early as Sunday. And there's anger in southern Thailand as the statute of limitations has passed to prosecute soldiers for the death of almost 80 Muslim protesters back in 2004. A former Lord's Resistance Army commander, Thomas Kwayelo, has been sentenced to 40 years in prison in Uganda. He was part of the LRA, this Lord's Resistance Army. It was a militant Christian organisation founded back in 1985. It claimed to fight government oppression, but it had a terrible record of violence. Kwayelo has been convicted of murder, torture and rape back in August. This was the sentencing. One of the features of the LRA was the way it forced children to join up. And that happened to Kwayelo himself. He was abducted by rebels when he was just 12. Anyway, this was the sentencing announced by the judge in Kampala.
For all these counts and offences that he has now been found guilty, that he has now been sentenced on, it is deemed that the sentence of 40 years, which was meted out to him on the charges of murder, properly reflects the overall criminality of Thomas Kwayelo.
Well, let's hear now from a journalist in Uganda's capital, Kampala. It's Halima Athumani. Welcome to you. Thanks for bringing us up to date with what's happened with this. Is this a high-profile case, actually, in Uganda?
Hi, thank you for having me. It definitely is a high-profile case, irrespective of Thomas Kwayelo's ranking in the LRA leadership. We should know that this is the first LRA leader to be tried in Uganda. So definitely this is a high-profile case. Dominic Ongwen was tried in The Hague. So for Uganda to decide to try him under the International War Crimes Division of the High Court, this was definitely a big profile case for Uganda.
And do most people think it's the right thing to do for Uganda to confront, you know, the LRA?
Yes, because, you know, the LRA started this war in Uganda. So where else would be the best place to try anyone who lodged a campaign or a war against the country, but in its own soil? Actually, I think it even meant more meaning that the trial itself, the hearing of the case, the ruling, the sentencing today was not even something that happened in Kampala. They actually decided to take it home. So it was such a big deal. And home meaning Gulu district, where everything happened.
What about this aspect of the case that he himself was recruited at 12? So in a sense was a victim of the LRA. Do people think like that?
A couple of people actually did feel like that. The last time I was in court, I think people, women especially, those who were around the camp, because in the LRA conflict, you know, everyone had a camp. So there were those who would say, I was under the Dominic Ongwen camp, I was under the Kwayelo camp, everyone of course considers themselves Joseph Kony victim, but they had camps. So Kwayelo in particular was at this camp. And I think for many of them, they really were hoping that Kwayelo would come up and say, I am sorry, I did this. This was wrong of me. But he didn't. Maybe that would have seen, you know, the truth and reconciliation process starting up, but we didn't hear that. So for many victims today, this was really good news that, you know, finally someone is held accountable for these crimes.
And just to be clear, in Uganda, the LRA is no longer a force.
Not at all, actually. So we all know that the LRA launched its war against the current president, Yoweri Museveni, about 2 years after he got into power. And since then, also Kwayelo himself was actually constricted into the war in around 1987. So maybe a year later, when he was about the age of 12. So right now we know that there actually is no activity in Uganda as far as the LRA is concerned. But there are reports that in the 2010s, Kony actually moved with his troops, the remaining that was, that did not, you know, seek for amnesty to through the Ugandan government. They crossed and went into the Central African Republic and South Sudan. And in the Sudanese-controlled Kafia Kingi area, that's where they are at the moment. So this is where they are now staying. So no one can really say for sure where, but, you know, there are suspicions that either he's in the CAR.
Thank you, Halima. We're going to have to drop it there because we need to get on to the next piece. Thank you very much indeed, Halima Athumani there. Now, the BBC has filmed people smugglers saying they use warehouses in Germany to store the small boats that carry migrants across the English Channel. Germany says continuous measures are being taken to tackle this issue. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker has the story.
A boat engine is fired up in a video sent by a smuggler to our undercover journalist, who's posing as a Syrian migrant hoping to get to Britain. He's wearing a secret camera when we drop him off in Essen city centre, West Germany.
I'm sure I don't need to say this, but if you do feel at all uncomfortable, you just go. It's not a problem.
Months of groundwork have led up to this moment. Our guy is just a couple of streets away having a meeting with his contact. We've got a tracker on him. We're parked up here. We don't want to get too close. That could compromise things. But we've got to be close enough in case there's a problem and we have to get him out of there.
OK, so, yeah, tell us what happened.
Due to strict German law, we recorded the video, not the sound of this meeting. So our journalist is telling me what happened right after.
I met with the contact, Abu Sahar. We went to the cafe and sat outside. Then Abu Sahar tells me, lower your voice. He is coming. It's a man called Al-Khal, which means the uncle. Like the boss. Big respect.
For his safety, his recollections are voiced by a BBC producer.
They took my phone. Al-Khal started asking questions. Who are you? What are you planning? I want to know all about you.
Our man seems to win their trust as the smugglers reveal details of their network.
They tell me the equipment comes from Turkey. They have about 10 warehouses around Essen. Police raided one a few days ago, but they separate their stock and give the bait to police.
This testimony is backed up by messages and voice notes where the main smuggler contact, Abu Sahar, discusses certain engine models and known migrant crossing points. The videos he shared include a boat out on the water, set to music. It's like an advert.
Well, I don't think anybody should be in a boat like that.
Neil Dalton, chair of the National Independent Lifeboat Association, has looked at the footage.
I think death trap is probably a very good description of it. The boat isn't designed to take 50 people or even 60 people. You know, it's definitely not suitable for trying to cross the channel in. It's appalling.
Britain's National Crime Agency has confirmed to us that Germany's a central location for storing boats that are eventually used in channel crossings, something our investigation brings to light. Because cities like Essen are just a few hours' drive from the Calais region, but not too close to its more heavily monitored beaches. While under German law, helping to smuggle people out of the EU to a third country like the UK isn't technically illegal. Even so, the Germans have helped carry out raids and arrests. Back at the cafe, it's down to business.
The smuggler says one option. I can get you a boat. You will pay me 15,000 euros. You will get the boat with 60 life jackets and all the equipment, guaranteed delivery to the Calais area. They tell me they have a new crossing point. No one knows about it.
From West Germany to here, the shores of northeastern France, where you can find deflated boats that look very like the ones we've seen pictures of, the remnants of failed and sometimes fatal attempts to get to Britain, while gangs, as we've shown, continue to make big money from this misery.
And that was Jessica Parker. And the UK government has said it is rapidly accelerating cooperation with countries on this, including Germany. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeine reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung. Und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe. Das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden, guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election, and how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The baby monkey at the heart of a global monkey torture ring, and yes, there is such a thing apparently, has been released back into the wild. Taken from the forest in Indonesia when just days old, Minnie's owner tortured her and filmed that for sadistic customers in the US and the UK. As another monkey being held with her were rescued after a BBC investigation. And Rebecca Henschke, who spent over a year tracking down Minnie and her torturers, went along for the release.
It's 5 o'clock in the morning and we've arrived at a black sand beach and a truck has just pulled up that's been driving through the night. Inside the truck is metal boxes, there's around 40 of them, and the one that I'm staring at has Mini written on it.
Denny Rahmadani, one of the vets, is checking in on her.
We give hydration and vitamin for Mini. It's very nice, very active. And nice condition.
She looks like she's ready to go back to the wild. The monkeys are being loaded in their boxes onto small fishing boats. Crossing over to a pristine jungle-covered island reserve that's been a protected area since the Dutch colonial times. So it's the perfect place for Minnie to be released into.
I first saw Minnie in this video. Just days old and very vulnerable, she was being abused in a bathroom. It was one of many videos.
This Minnie, bro, you know, artist in YouTube, but we can torture in here.
The people who were commissioning the torture were on the other side of the world, mainly in the US and the UK. We went undercover to expose the sadistic community and rescue Minnie. After 2 years at a sanctuary run by the Jakarta Animal Action Network, the founder, Femke Den Haas, says she's ready.
They underwent like a very long process of rehabilitation, different stages. We observe every detail of this process and they are ready to be an independent long-tailed macaque back in the forest where they belong.
Everyone has to carry a monkey. I'm tasked with taking Minnie.
It's hot. She's moving around a lot. She can hear the sounds of the forest and the other monkeys out there.
They're released into a temporary net cage where they can recover from the journey. And then a few days later, we return.
We're waiting behind a tree and the net is being ripped open and the monkeys are jumping right out of the net, right onto a tree. And there goes Minnie. She's leaping into the trees. On the other side of the world, those responsible for torturing her are being put behind bars. But Minnie has just gone free.
And that was Rebecca Henschke on that monkey who was saved from torture and then released. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, if globalisation encouraged freer global trade, then the backlash to it is leading the US anyway to a far more protectionist position. Donald Trump, when he was president, and then Joe Biden both imposed tariffs and taxes on certain Chinese imports. And if Mr. Trump wins again, he says he wants to go much further and impose a tariff on all imports. Now, for Mexico, that would be a big problem. It is now the number one exporter to the US. And NewsHour's James Menendez has been looking into this. He joins us live now, James.
Owen, thank you very much indeed. Welcome once again to San Antonio in South Texas, where today we are looking at the commercial ties that bind this part of the US to Mexico, just a short drive south of here. The US and Mexico have enjoyed a close trading relationship for 30 years now, ever since the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, came into force together with Canada. It was signed here in San Antonio, incidentally. That was updated into a new treaty during Donald Trump's first term as president. He famously called NAFTA the worst trade deal ever. But now, as he campaigns for a second term, the patter is about putting up barriers rather than taking them down. A promise to put a universal tariff on imports into the US, perhaps 10 or even 20%. Ironically, it's tariffs on goods from China that have given a huge boost to manufacturing in northern Mexico, nearshoring as it's known. And it's there we began our journey, in the commercial hub of Monterrey, where all sorts of businesses are benefiting from that proximity to the border. The street market in a place called Guadalupe, it looks like pretty much any market you might find around the world. People are selling all sorts of things, from fresh vegetables here. To the right of me, there's a woman selling jewellery and handbags. But lots of these stallholders are selling clothes. And it's a good illustration of the extent of the trade across the border between Mexico and the US, because these clothes have all come from the United States. Lots of them are second-hand clothes. Some of them are clothes that shops can't sell. They're brought across the border by wholesalers, and then the market traders here buy them, buy perhaps, 100 kilos, perhaps even half a ton of clothes, and then sell them at this market.
Nosotros tenemos 20...
People like Eva, who's been doing this for a quarter of a century and making a living out of it.
Because the border's always been so close, it makes it easy to buy and sell stuff across it, especially something like secondhand clothes from the U.S., and we can make a living out of it.
But much of the trade across the border is on a much bigger scale. At this factory in Monterrey, they're producing small precision tool parts for the car industry, the biggest employer here. Sergio Lopez, the owner of the business, tells me that since COVID, his exports to the US have been growing fast. The proximity of the border means that he can get the parts to his customers quickly and cheaply. So how worried is he by Donald Trump's campaign pledge to impose a universal tariff on imports into the US?
Mr. Trump is a businessman. He's tough, but I think he knows how far to go. I understand that he wants to protect his country and his people, but imposing this tariff is like the U.S. shooting itself in the foot, because the only thing it'll bring is more problems.
Last year, almost all exports from the state of Nuevo León went to the United States, goods worth $55 billion. But almost half that amount traveled in the other direction, from the U.S. into this state. Indeed, some products move across the border several times as they're assembled, a complex web of supply chains built up over years, ever since the US, Mexico and also Canada signed their free trade agreement in the early 1990s.
Tariffs between partners probably is not the best position.
That's the understated verdict of Jesus Francisco Lopez from the Monterrey Chamber of Commerce. He says Mexico isn't taking American jobs. Rather, he argues, it's stopping even more manufacturing moving to Asia.
We don't compete, we complement each other. If one competitor is there, it's going to be Asia, and China mainly. So it's reasonable for the three countries to talk between us and talk how we can be more competitive together, but at the end it's a North American product.
And at the heart of that network of supply chains is this place, Port Laredo in Texas. It is now the biggest trading post in the whole of the United States, with a vast army of trucks carrying everything from cars to computers and furniture to food across the bridge over the river that marks the border. Tens of thousands of these huge trucks every single day. In August alone, more than $30 billion worth of goods traveled through here. Some south into Mexico, most of it though heading north on the highway into Texas and beyond. It is the funnel, if you like, for what is a vast trading partnership. And that partnership also provides opportunities for Mexican companies wanting to expand into the United States. At a networking event in San Antonio, I meet Victor Reyna, president of the Association of Mexican Entrepreneurs in the city.
There's a lot of Mexican business owners either extending operations to the U.S. or already, you know, establishing or already established here in the U.S. So, yeah, we see a lot of manufacturing. We see a lot of logistic companies, a lot of service providers that are here relocating to the U.S. from Mexico.
So if there were to be, as Donald Trump has promised, a universal tariff on imports into the U.S., what would that mean, do you think, considering how much trade there is between northern Mexico and southern Texas? It would mean a huge cost for companies in this part of the world, right?
100%. I do see that. I do see it. It'll be, yes, increase in supply chain. I mean, it's just going to disrupt, you know, the commercial trade between the two countries, definitely.
And that cost will be passed on to the consumer inevitably, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it'll be passed on us, and that's what's going to hurt.
Victor Reyna, president of the Association of Mexican Entrepreneurs here in the U.S. Well, let's discuss some of those issues with Shannon O'Neill, an expert on global trade and U.S.-Mexico relations at the think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. Shannon joins me from New York. Welcome to NewsHour.
Thanks so much for having me.
How seriously do you take Donald Trump when he talks about a tariff on all imports?
You know, I take him seriously and at his word. You know, many of the things that he says on the campaign trail, he wants to implement. And tariffs are something that he has been talking about since the 1980s. This seems to be one of his true beliefs. So I do think this is something that we should all be thinking about and preparing for. And he did that in his first term on many countries, particularly steel and aluminum. So get ready for it again.
Yes, he calls himself a tariff man, doesn't he? Presumably, if he did introduce that universal tariff, there'd be retaliatory tariffs from those exporting countries, right?
Right. One would imagine that they would respond. If we look at his first term, he put tariffs on steel and aluminum across all sorts of countries, and then he went to each one of them to negotiate them off. So Mexico negotiated them off, and that is how, in part, the what's called the Remain in Mexico policy, where Mexico kept tens of thousands of asylum seekers in Mexico while they awaited their time in court here in the United States. So he tied it to migration policy. South Korea, Brazil, some other countries negotiated them off, working with the U.S. government. Other countries, particularly those in Europe, did not. And so you still see retaliatory tariffs on both sides of the border there as a result.
It isn't just Republicans who have become more protectionist, is it? It's Democrats too. And I guess many people listening to this may be thinking, well, we should be protecting American manufacturing and American jobs. What's your response to that?
So we have seen what were the Trump tariffs against China have continued on and been the Biden tariffs, and both Harris and Trump have talked about keeping those for national security reasons, for competitiveness reasons. So I think some of that we will see. The challenge, which you rightly bring up in your reporting, is twofold. One is that tariffs really are a direct tax on consumers. So as we worry about inflation here in the United States, this adds to inflation. And two, tariffs on countries like Mexico, like Canada, that are other trading partners, you know, they buy significant amounts of exports from the United States, which supports lots of U.S. factories and services and jobs here in the United States. And so if you put tariffs on particularly those countries that are such important trading partners in creating all kinds of industries, all kinds of products, cars and machines and textiles and all sorts of things. If you put tariffs on, you may often be hitting jobs that are here in the United States, not just in those other countries.
But thinking about Mexico in particular, if goods are being made there and wages are lower in Mexico, I mean, that is taking jobs away from the United States, isn't it?
You know, I think that only works if you think about the United States in isolation. And today, when you look at the global economy, U.S. producers of goods are competing with supply chains all over the world, and they're competing with particularly Asian supply chains. It's not just China. It is Asian supply chains where countries have come together there and make products that are, you know, good, affordable, high quality, and very quickly. And so if the United States is going to compete with an Asian-made electronic or car or furniture or clothing or whatever it is that you're thinking about, it's hard to do it alone because you can't gain the economies of scale, sort of the size and the scope and the specialization, that competitiveness alone anymore in the global economy.
And thinking about China, is it now on to the benefits of being in Mexico too, trying to get round some of those tariffs by putting its own companies there across the border?
You've seen lots of companies from all over the world move into Mexico and to the United States, frankly, to take advantage of the tariff-free access that the USMCA, the free trade agreement, provides in these three countries. And China is now following, you know, the Germans and the French and the Japanese and all sorts of other national companies into that. And I think here the real question for Mexico, the United States, and Canada is, how do you deal with China and the supply chains there? Some things, you know, maybe it's, you know, clothing or washing machines. Maybe those don't pose a national security threat. But others that have high technology, you know, we're wrestling that with in Washington. What really matters for U.S. national security? And Mexico, too, is beginning to wrestle with it as well.
Shannon, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Much appreciated. Shannon O'Neill, expert on global trade and those relations between the United States and Mexico that we've been looking into all this week. Shannon's from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Back to you in the studio, Owen.
Thanks very much indeed. That was James Menendez there in southern Texas. Just a reminder that if you ever want to get up to date with the program, because you might have missed it, then we do produce podcasts twice a day. So that's twice a day, every day of the year, BBC NewsHour podcast. So you go to wherever you get your podcasts, and if you put in BBC NewsHour, should come up. And then you need never be wondering what's happening in the world. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, there was a time 10 years or so ago when the Pakistan Army could boast, and it did, that it had run one of the most successful counterinsurgency campaigns in the world. It fought hard against the Taliban in northwest Pakistan, and it won. But since then, the Taliban have been making a comeback, and at least 10 security personnel have been killed after militants stormed an outpost near the Afghan border. Iftikhar Firdous is the editor of the Khorasan Diary. It covers the insurgency in northwest Pakistan and Afghanistan, and he came through from Torkham on the Afghan-Pakistan border. So, how were the Taliban able to mount this major attack?
This is a paramilitary checkpoint that's located on the border on fringes of the tribal areas. We've seen numerous attacks being carried out on the main road, and this checkpoint is just located very closely. Last night, we saw about 20 to 25 militants entering the security checkpoint. And since they're paramilitary forces, they're not that well armed, and they were not prepared for the attack. They managed to enter the checkpoint, and in indiscriminate firing, they managed to kill 10 security personnel from the frontier constabulary, while the military was in the backup, and they managed to save at least 6 more lives that were there. But this is a consistent phenomenon that we've seen in the southern parts of the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province after 2021.
So, exactly, the Taliban have been sort of resurgent, but you are now in Torkham on the Afghan Pakistan border, and I think there's another attack underway near there, isn't there?
This is the area of Torkham in the Khyber district, which is obviously just adjacent to Afghanistan. And in one of its portions, which is known as the Tira Valley, We've seen recent escalation of violence with at least six different attacks in the last 1 month targeting Pakistani security personnel. This is one of those incidents again, and we're initially receiving information that there have been at least five fatalities from the Pakistani security forces, and these clashes are still ongoing. The Pakistani Taliban have claimed responsibility for both attacks. The one that was there last night, they say that it was a retaliation for an intelligence-based operation in which the Pakistani security personnel killed at least nine of Taliban, including one of their top commanders.
Now, are these Pakistan Taliban fighters based in Afghanistan and then just coming over, attacking and going back, or are they based in Pakistan?
In the last couple of months, we've seen numerous Pakistani Taliban fighters accompanied by the Afghan Taliban moving into Pakistan's terrain, carrying out attacks, and then moving back as well. The border, which was once considered to be a secure part, is no longer considered to be secure, and this has been the cause of diplomatic tensions between Pakistan and the Afghan Taliban as well.
There were many in the Pakistani security establishment who celebrated the Afghan Taliban victory in Kabul and Kandahar. And now it seems what the liberals said would happen is happening, that the Afghan Taliban are fighting in Pakistan.
Absolutely. And I think that romancing of the Pakistani establishment with the Afghan Taliban has seen quite a considerable change. For the first time since the 1980s, we saw the Pakistanis actually changing their stance against the Afghan Taliban and the Afghan public as well, facing the brunt of it. In the beginning of this year, a process that started last year, we've seen hundreds and thousands of Afghan refugees that called Pakistan home being sent back, repatriated, forceful repatriation, which the government does not acknowledge, sending them back to Afghanistan as a result of a policy of clamping down on Afghanistan's policy generally. So we've seen those relationships deteriorate, and there does not seem to be any end to it. This has affected diplomatic ties, it's affected trade ties, and it's affected the ties between the people on both sides of the border as well.
And that was Iftikhar Firdous, editor of the Khorasan Diary. He was speaking to us from the Afghan-Pakistan border on NewsHour. A surgeon in Scotland has worked out a way to remove brain tumours, even up to the size of apples, through patients' eyebrows. It is keyhole surgery, and it has a number of advantages, less scarring, a four-hour operation rather than an eight-hour one, and speedy recovery. Many patients stay in hospital for just a day. Well, the consultant neurosurgeon who's done all this is Anastasios Giamariadis of NHS Grampian. And I asked him to explain just what he does.
The eyebrow approach for brain surgery in the front of the brain is used for a long time now from many colleagues all around the world, but only for, as far as tumours is concerned, for small tumours. With my team, we have modified that approach, and we are able to remove very large brain tumours from the front as far back as the middle of the brain, purely through the eyebrow with a very small lateral extension.
How can you do that? I mean, if you've got a small incision, as I understand it, above the eyebrow or through the eyebrow, then how can you get something, you know, the size of an apple out of that?
Yes, we don't remove the tumours en bloc. We have special instruments, and we debulk, as we say. So we remove the centre of the tumour, first of all, and slowly then we remove the capsule, which is strictly adherent to vital neurovascular structures in that area. Optic nerves, carotid arteries, which keep us alive, and very, very important functions.
And what would terrify me as a surgeon doing that is if you slip and you sort of get the instrument wrong, it's going to take some of the brain away, isn't it?
That would happen in any brain operation.
Yeah,
so we expose less healthy brain as possible, and this is what makes the recovery so fast. With a traditional approach, more or less the half of the brain is exposed for quite some time in theater, and that obviously has implications. Through the eyebrow, we slide under the brain on the skull base, as we say. There are a lot of technical aspects in it, like drilling the inner bone of the skull. So we have a nice cosmetic effect, but at the same time, we have enough access to do the operation. And then remove the main bulk of the tumor with some special instruments, which are called ultrasonic aspirators. and then do the very delicate, very intricate last part of the operation and remove the complex part of it.
How many of these have you done?
48 to date. About a dozen of them, it's for the very large ones. The rest of them, it's for tumors that other people would also have tried to do. Most of them are benign, slow-growing tumors, hence they reach such a big size. But we have done a handful of very aggressive, very extensive tumors successfully.
And all gone well?
There is no serious complication directly related to the technique.
Well, it's amazing work, and congratulations. And then presumably your task now is to show others this technique so that this can happen all around the world.
It's not a one-man show, it's a teamwork. I have fantastic colleagues who we do these operations together, and we're in the process of building up a simulation program because, as you can imagine, it's very risky to try to teach someone this approach on a patient. So first we will do it through a virtual reality concept, and then we will roll it out slowly.
And that was Anastasios Giamouriadis, and he brings us to an end of this edition of the program. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe, das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election, and how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.